Hi, this is Dina Fulton with Prevent Connect, and I'm here with David Malbranche.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining us. So in your work focusing on Black MSM and HIV and all sorts of different sexual risk behaviors and sexual networks, how has masculinity and gender socialization played a role in those health outcomes that you've been talking about?
It's played a huge role, and obviously I don't think a lot of the formative work with masculinity, and particularly when it pertains to Black men, is not along a diverse sexual continuum. So there tends to be more studies looking at masculinity among Black men in general, or just heterosexual kind of cis-identified Black men. So that's one drawback that we have. The few qualitative studies that I've worked on, we've shown that this masculinity issue really plays a role in a lot of different variables in how we see and how we navigate same-sex relationships, sexual networking, social networking, so on and so forth. So, for instance, we see it in the way of how people choose their sexual partners. So if someone looks kind of masculine in a traditional sense, and particularly for Black men, it could be having a lot of muscles, a certain kind of swag or attitude that you carry with you, that will be deemed as more desirable than someone who may embody more traditionally feminine qualities. It also plays a role with regards to behaviors as far as whether you're going to be the top or the bottom. So obviously people will target, if someone is attracted to someone who's more feminine, they're looking at them because they want to be the top in that relationship, and they're perceiving that someone who has external traits that more embody a feminine persona, that they would say, well, okay, this person's going to be the receptive partner when we have anal sex because their behavior is more feminine. The final part of it that comes into play is with regards to condom use. And so it's somewhat based in fact, but then it gets extrapolated as to not really. And the reason why I say that is because when we look at how HIV is transmitted, it's mostly through anal sex. And if we break that down even further, it's mostly the receptive partner in anal sex. And the reason being because the skin on the penis is tougher, it's meant for small abrasions or friction. So you're not going to get easy access to the bloodstream if you're the top. But the receptive partner, there's much more likelihood of kind of trauma and small tears inside the rectum, so therefore it's more easily transmitted. People do kind of understand that fact of the reality, and so where the extrapolation happens is that they'll say if someone is a top or gives a masculine performance, they're going to think they're less likely to contract HIV from that person.
It's really interesting because in sexual violence prevention, we spend a lot of time talking about power differentials with gender presentation and gender inequity in society and how that sort of enables people to, A, feel like they're entitled to sexual activity, and B, not get sanctioned for any sort of aggressive sexual behavior that they exhibit. And so a lot of the work that we try and do is reshaping masculinity. We often think about these in terms of heterosexual relationships, but it sounds really clear from what you're saying that similar sorts of power dynamics are really evident even within same gender partnerships. The power that allows some people to feel entitled to whatever sexual activity that they want and sort of disregard other people's autonomy also plays out in HIV transmission and in other sexual risk behaviors.
It has definite potential too, and I think we have to be careful with making conclusive statements about it, unfortunately, because if people don't see a p-value attached to it or some kind of quantitative analysis or a prospective trial, they think that it's not legitimate. And I've seen folks do different repeats with masculine studies, and some of these same themes come over and over again. A lot of folks have argued that this kind of anti-feminine discrimination that happens even within like gay communities and gay enclaves, and even to that extent some of the transphobia that we see in LGBT communities, is kind of a reflection of like overall sexism that we don't want to acknowledge. And I think those same kind of traditional stereotypes and tropes play out in same gender relationships. And I hear it all the time with some of the young brothers I talk to on Facebook and some of the ones I've worked with and research studies and interacted with in social studies. The brothers that are more feminine in their performance, they catch hell as far as the assumptions that are made, the power differential that is made, the kind of cachet they have within LGBT communities. It's really problematic.
So I'm wondering if you know of any HIV prevention work that works on these sort of issues of gender dynamics or gender presentation dynamics.
Not offhand. I've seen studies with work with kind of redefining masculine tropes or analyzing those things as a way of HIV prevention, but that was among heterosexual Black men. I don't think that barrier has been crossed with regards to behavioral interventions within like LGBT circles or within same-gender loving relationships. And what's interesting now is that just as we were starting to find out a lot of these, you know, social contextual factors, particularly around masculinity, that was when PrEP kind of took off, like a few years ago, it started to take off. So now the focus for HIV prevention is much more around the biomedical interventions, and less money and less attention is being paid to strictly behavioral preventions. Even if you do some behavioral interventions, it has to be coupled with some kind of biomedical component, or else you pretty much won't get funded.
For our audience who's probably less familiar, could you just give a quick overview of what PrEP is?
Yeah, PrEP is a pre-exposure prophylaxis. So it's a pill with the intention of giving it to people who are HIV negative, and they take it once a day in order to prevent HIV infection. And it's been around since 2012. But the more the years go along, the more studies we find that it's working among very diverse populations. In addition to treatment as prevention, where we're focusing on people who are positive, getting them on treatment and undetectable, that being a form of prevention in and of itself, PrEP has kind of emerged as the opposite side of the spectrum, where we're focusing on people who are currently HIV negative and what they can do on a daily basis to protect themselves.
Good. And I really think PrEP is a very interesting approach, especially in the sexual violence field. It's like, you know,
right,
there's not much that you can do to minimize the trauma and minimize the, you know, negative consequences of experiencing sexual violence. But PrEP is like sort of one way you can take control. And I remember you talking about this in the MSM community as well, and consensual experiences. It's like one way that you can take control of your own health.
Right. I think particularly when we look at women, and what we said with women in the past is like, well, okay, well, let's make a female condom, or let's try to do a vaginal microbicide. And some of these other things really haven't panned out as well as far as the science is concerned. They haven't been shown to prevent HIV. So I think from a sexual violence perspective, it really holds a lot of potential, although the studies have traditionally been focused on MSM. But when you look at it in the sexual violence field, this is something that a woman can take every day. It may not prevent against some of the other STIs and some of the other physical and emotional trauma that goes along with these coercive situations, but at least you can do something to prevent against HIV, and at least it is in that person's control. So in that respect, it's much better studied. The outcomes and the science behind it are more well proven, and they just seem to be more effective than microbicides and female condoms do.
And then the other aspect of your presentation that I was really interested in was all these experiences of medical providers that Black MSM shared with you in the qualitative study. And I was just like really floored at the quality of the excerpts that you shared and the experiences that these folks have when they go to the doctor. Could you just, I don't know if you know off the top of your head any of the examples of some of the issues that people brought up?
And it's interesting because literally we published that study about 10 years ago. But every time I present that data, they nod their heads in approval because they're still seeing those same dynamics going on today. And you'd like to think that the context of medical environments is much more accepting, but I had an example of a patient who had a penile lesion that I saw, and he was worried that it was an STD, obviously. And he had gone to see another doctor at another practice, and the doctor tested him for gonorrhea, chlamydia, and then for HIV. And I said, well, did the doctor test you for syphilis? And he said, you know, it's funny that you say that because I asked the doctor, should you check me for syphilis? And he said, no, that only happens with homosexuals. And so he didn't even, and this is 2015, so he didn't even test him. You hear those kind of stories all the time. So I'm very clear that these dynamics still go on today. And I haven't seen a whole lot of studies incorporating that. And I think we talk about, you know, structural and social issues like poverty, access to care. And the one glaring omission that we have in all this is that we don't put that microscope on ourselves as medical providers, and we don't analyze the medical system and the one-on-one interactions between providers and patients and how that influences one's overall experience and how that influences whether one returns to a clinic, whether one adheres to medications. And I think more of those studies need to be done because the providers either aren't competent or judgmental. That's a problem, but we don't talk about as much.
I think I definitely have heard stories about that sort of dynamic being played out in sexual and intimate partner violence prevention as well. We talk a lot about the root causes of violence, and we'll identify things like, as I said before, gender inequity, and also things like racism, and for Native communities, histories of colonization, and all these sort of like root underlying big societal oppressions and inequities. And
right.
We often try and make that a focus of the content of our programs. We often address these things, but it's a lot harder for providers of prevention services to sort of look at their practice and their program from like a meta perspective. You know, who are we engaging in planning these programs? How
mm-hmm.
are we making sure that our messages are relevant to the communities we're working with? How are we
mm-hmm.
making sure that the messaging that we're sending out isn't offensive and turning people off and keeping people from being engaged with this messaging? And so it sounds like, you know, I think across the board, it's hard to examine ourselves in that way. And I think it can have real consequences for how effective the work is.
Obviously, there's pockets of us that are kind of working really hard to dispel a lot of that judgment, a lot of the stigma that happens within medical settings to a lot of the patients that come in. But it's hard to keep up because the culture is more so a conservative one. And sometimes it's challenging to erase the perception or past experiences that people have had within medical settings and get them to trust you.
Yeah, I remember you were saying that there were some Black MSM patients who are in your studies who said that they didn't tell their providers that they were having sex with men because, you know, they
right.
already came in being Black, and so that was already one strike against them in,
right.
in terms of their relationship with the provider, and they didn't want to make it even more difficult.
In a lot of the studies that you see, all it's reported as is Black MSM are less likely to disclose their sexual orientation than their white colleagues. And it's actually concluded that it's some kind of internal pathological deficit that we are just uncomfortable with our sexuality. Then you have this data that we're researching where it says, you know, no, there's actually a thought process to it, which is kind of logical, that says, well, hey, I'm living as a Black man in this world and I've been discriminated against multiple times. And so why would I open up that avenue for you to discriminate against me more if you're already judging me when I come in the door? And people will say variance versus perceived racism, and I don't think it matters whether it's perceived or experienced at the end of the day, because if the person is feeling it and if it influences their behaviors about what they do later, if they go for follow-up, if they take meds, if they, you know, discuss things honestly with a provider, then it's a problem.
First of all, I loved that you credited Kimberly Crenshaw in your presentation, because I really appreciate when people don't do that. I was like, when you had that slide up, I was like, yes. Yeah.
you were like, he gets it. Great. Yeah,
yep.
Because I've been too. And I don't think Kimberly was the first one who came up with the concept, but she was the one that really brought it into prominence and
mm-hmm.
in the context of like Black feminist thought. So I think we have to be very clear and pay homage to like those origins when we're talking about intersectionality, instead of just throwing it out there like it's a term that's always been around and, you know, people have always got it.
Acknowledging these experiences that folks have with multiple oppressions and making sure that that's not, you know,
mm-hmm.
ignored in your mm-hmm. interactions with community members or patients in your case, it's really central to the effectiveness of your work. And like you said, it's not about pathologizing what is a logical response to experiencing these multiple oppressions. It's about
right.
understanding where they come from and trying to relate to people about them and make sure that you, in, you know, as a service provider or a clinician or as a prevention provider, are making sure that your work and your language and your practices and even, you know, the spaces in which you work and the communities
right.
and, you know, contexts in which you work are respectful of
right.
these folks' experiences.
Right, absolutely. I had a young lady come in here the other day who was Muslim and she was Saudi. And she was a virgin, so, you know, in Muslim culture, you're not supposed to allow medical providers to do a physical exam on you. Before I was going to do the physical exam, I remember just stopping myself, and I was like, wait a minute. I said, would you prefer a female provider, you know, to kind of continue on? And she was like, yes, absolutely. And so she wasn't going to ask at first. And you have to realize that when patients come in that space, there's a power dynamic already set up. And so she may have well let me perform like a very rudimentary clinical exam on her and not said a word just because she didn't feel it was going to be appropriate, but that would have been culturally traumatic for her.
I love two of the points that you just made, and I think they're so applicable to prevention, violence prevention work as well. The first, that you have to be aware of your own position of power, that you have to be constantly thinking about that and aware of what that means for your work, and also
right.
that it's on the person with more power to make accommodations.
Right.
It's not on the
right.
person with less power.
And I think those power dynamics play out, and particularly with sexual violence, like the kind of interaction that you may have in an ER or with a clinic afterwards, and can either make or break, you know, someone's recovery from an event like that.
And even all
right.
these questions of, like, why did the person who had less power situationally not stick up for themselves? And it's like, well, you know, because of the power differential. And that's, like,
right.
the same reason.
Right.
The same reason this occurred is the reason that they didn't, you know, stick up for themselves, and that, you know, that's valid and that's real and it's not any shortcoming of that person.
We do try to work on the empowerment of the victims, but I think traditional gender norms influences men behaving badly, both in heterosexual relationships, same gender relationships, everything in between. It's just interesting that we don't focus as much on that aspect of it and kind of redefining those norms for men. And what you need to kind of pay better attention to, in addition to, because I think you have to do both simultaneously. It's not that it's going to be one or the other. So
yeah, there's a role for
no.
everything. It's interesting because this is sort of the sexual and intimate partner violence prevention structure's wheelhouse, I guess, is the sort of gender equity and gender socialization stuff. So it seems like that might be an interesting way for HIV prevention and violence prevention folks to partner and sort of have a give and take. And so in HIV prevention, perhaps we could contribute to the behavioral as opposed to the biomedical part of prevention. And then from you all's experience, like, you all have more intimate understanding of the dynamics that go on in same gender relationships and sex partnerships and sexual networks and the resistance to getting service and or accessing service and adherence and all this stuff. And so I feel like there's a lot of knowledge exchange that could go on that would strengthen both of our work.
Especially with the intersection of sexual violence with HIV prevention, this whole biomedical approach, I do think there's a lot of applications outside of just focusing on MSM. And I think these are situations where you could have somebody who's in a relationship and does, and there's a power dynamic where they feel disempowered. And how do you do some harm reduction in those scenarios? And that's why I think PrEP actually can play a decent role and play an alternative or an adjunct to kind of other things we may be encouraging.
I remember studying a lot about how Black heterosexual women were actually among the fastest growing group of HIV positive folks, and how there's all these other sorts of dynamics going on that we're not, you know, traditionally focused on because the focus really has been on MSM, where it's like we're missing whole populations.
Right.
And there are all these other dynamics going on within these sort of different kinds of relationships that we need to be learning about and focusing on as well.
You know, there are obviously very specific things that you're going to deal with in same-gender relationships that may be different from heterosexual relationships, but I think there's applications where you can make, like, general concessions or, you know, recommend PrEP or recommend certain behavioral approaches in the relationship regardless of the two individuals in the relationship, because there's a certain power dynamic no matter who you're looking at.
That is something that we might shy away from because, you know, we're striving for equity. But the reality is equity is not a stable thing. It's an ongoing process, and it's always going to be tipped a little bit to one side or another. And so it's how do we navigate making sure that everyone has safety and access to or the ability to have positive health outcomes despite whatever imbalance there may be. It's always so great and so valuable to hear that, you know, the same kinds of dynamics that we're trying to address are relevant to so many other fields, and it just sort of validates the work that we're all doing. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to talk with me. It's been really, really great to hear about your perspectives and think about some of the connections between our work.
No worries. I love it. Thanks for taking the time again. I appreciate it.